News 101, Vancouver's volunteer-produced student and community newscast. Now, here are your hosts, Katie Comley and Rita Farkas.
Good evening. Coming up on the program, Vancouver Council votes to ban businesses from using alleyway dumpsters.
Carol Taylor announces she will not be running in the next provincial election.
And on commentary this week, Phil Caudry evaluates the Vancouver 2010 Olympic Committee's choice of three mascots to promote Vancouver and the Winter Olympics.
We'll have all this plus arts, sports, and your weekend weather forecast coming up in the next 45 minutes right here on News 101.
But first, here's a piece from our friends at Radio Free UBC. They're interviewing Jamie Doucette, one of the organizers of last Friday's event, 10 years later, UBC Anti-APEC Protests Reunion.
So I'm here with Jamie Doucette. He's a geography graduate student at UBC. He's an organizer for the APEC 10 years later, and I'm going to ask him a few questions about the event. And so, Jamie, what's the purpose and the meaning of APEC 10 years later?
Well, it's been 10 years since the APEC protests here in 1997 against the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Leaders Summit. And it was a really formative event in a lot of our own personal histories. A lot of the APEC generation, so to speak, went on to play a large role in organizing later anti-globalization protests, be it in Seattle, Quebec City, some in Europe, other parts of the world. And I think it's, you know, we thought this was a good opportunity to sort of take a step back, assess the legacy, how it's influenced our own personal choices, where we are now, what we want to get involved in the future.
Cool. And so are you guys going to be sort of talking about APEC and its sort of successors and the effects of the APEC history and the effects of free trade in the present and politics today?
Sure, yeah. I mean, we're going to try our best to sort of show how, in some ways, the APEC agenda, how that was taken up by later institutional formations. Of course, actually, APEC itself broke down. The WTO has had problems launching its new development round, but certain parts of these trade agreements are still active today, whether it be in the SPP or in TILMA, which sort of affect Canada internally, or in sort of bilateral agreements between countries. But of course, APEC was never really just about trade. It was about violence. It was about, you know, a lot of issues. You know, a lot of people came out to protest the original APEC meeting because of Suharto was here, or because of different heads of state that were involved in, you know, repressing dissent or military adventures. So I think, you know, you can't just sort of isolate the APEC agenda or the role of APEC just to the trade meetings, but other sort of aspects. I mean, a lot of us went on to take part in the anti-war movement. There's people who were involved in issues back home around native sovereignty, immigration rights. So it's sort of both the problems of the economy and the problems of the state that we encountered back in the day that have kind of continued on. And I mean, I think it's an open discussion about where these things sit today. Obviously, there's lots of institutional manifestations of these things, and it's a good chance here to discuss them.
Cool. So what exactly happened when you guys confronted the APEC meeting here on campus?
Sure. I mean, it's complicated. I mean, we started doing consciousness-raising events on campus, and in the days before the summit itself, the campus drastically changed. Fences went up. There's cops driving around everywhere. People remember the different little police vans. You know, there's high-profile arrests of student organizers. Myself, I was arrested just because Annetta and I had walkie-talkies, and we were helping coordinate first aid, and I guess they had a moment where they decided to grab anyone with a walkie-talkie. But later in the day, I was arrested in the morning of the 25th, but later in the day, you know, thousands of students came out to protest, and really, the cops just... It's kind of like the taser thing. They just sort of responded immediately with lots of pepper spray, lots of violence. Some of the people who are here, who took part in that part of the day, might be better equipped to talk about
that
sort of thing.
Cool.
But the general point is that the cops had a lot of money for security, and they kind of went nuts, imagining any threat to them. I mean, they were following around the leader of the NDP, they were following around the raging grannies, just all these resources, and no real idea about, you know, how to handle dissent. Because honestly, most of us are just very mild and peaceful. We never really...
Yeah, it was a nonviolent protest.
What
So what do you think is next in terms of the anti-globalization movement? You mentioned the SPP and resistance to the SPP today. Can you talk about the sort of future of the anti-free trade, anti-globalization movement, or also globalization?
I guess these things are quite complicated. Obviously, like, global bodies are no longer meeting in the way that they used to. The sort of global framework of these things is fragmented. It's kind of broken down. Nonetheless, I think there's lots of room to look at, to still posit the question of what's in different institutional arrangements, which lead to more, you know, equality, redistribution between people are. I mean, at home, those things, I think, are important at the urban level, you know, with the Olympics coming up, the effects of the Olympics on the city, you know, the continuing cutbacks in education, continuing problems surrounding immigration. There's lots of issues that connect back into these things we can look at.
And thanks to our friends at Radio Free UBC for that piece. Now with a look at other local news, here are Carrie Baptist and Tracy Fuller.
Vancouver City Council has voted to ban business from using dumpsters in city alleyways. Instead of using large dumpsters, businesses will have to separate their waste into recyclables, compost, returnables, and landfill garbage. The plan is to have these separate bags picked up throughout the day so that they don't sit for very long in the alley. City Councillor Kim Capri explains this new bylaw is a win-win situation, saying that it will make alleys cleaner and the bins will be safer. A representative with the Independent Waste Haulers Association, Ralph McRae, disagrees. He feels garbage haulers will not be supportive of the new measure because of the money already spent on dumpster-specific equipment.
Two Lower Mainland hospitals were ranked poorly in a new study of hospitals in Canada. The new study, conducted by the Canadian Institute for Health Information, took a look at preventable deaths in Canadian hospitals. This is the first time hospital mortality rates have been analyzed in Canada using a tool called the Hospital Standardized Mortality Ratio. Of the 85 facilities that participated in the study, Burnaby General ranked 78th and Surrey Memorial ranked 75th. This means that these two facilities have more deaths than should be expected given the types of patients treated and the severity of their health problems. There is good news for Vancouver residents, however, since Vancouver General came in 13th.
Businesses concerned with TransLink's controversial parking tax can breathe a sigh of relief. The provincial government has officially terminated an amendment regarding the tax to the Greater Vancouver Transportation Authority legislation. In its place, a levy is being spread across all residential and business classes of property taxes. The decision was welcomed by the Vancouver Fair Tax Coalition, who were strongly opposed to the parking tax. Transportation Minister Kevin Falcon sided with business owners, who are worried the taxes would only be a problem of commercial and industrial taxpayers. If they were to have gone through, the parking taxes would have gone to support transit.
And following a decade-long court battle, a recent ruling by the Supreme Court of Canada has determined the fate of a sign above the Lee Building at Main Street and Broadway. The building, which stands at a major intersection in Vancouver, will no longer have a sign that the owners have fought hard to try to save. The City of Vancouver banned billboards in the 1970s, but this billboard was erected in 1998, prompting the lengthy court case. The case moved from the BC Supreme Court to the BC Court of Appeal and finally to the Supreme Court of Canada. The Supreme Court refused to hear Robert Colin and Mary Louise Piercy's appeal and awarded court costs to the city. It is unknown how much the city will receive in legal fees as a result of the ruling. Carlene Robbins of the Bylaw Administration for Vancouver says the ruling is a victory because the city can now enforce the bylaw on other buildings. The administration was waiting until the final ruling of this case. We're now going to take a quick break, but stay tuned to CITR for much news following these public service announcements.
Boy, I'm glad we paid our electric bill.
Electricity is our servant in many ways.
Uh-oh, here we go again.
Oh, Terry, I'm interested. Where does electricity come from, Jasper?
I'm sorry I mentioned it.
Well, electricity can come from many places, from many different sources of power. Like hydroelectric power.
Hydroelectric?
Hydro means water. Water power to make electricity.
Want to learn more? Join Team PowerSmart.
Visit bchydro.com/teampowersmart to make a difference and conserve today. Influence the future of energy conservation in BC by entering BC Hydro's Innovation Challenge, open exclusively to participating post-secondary institutions in BC. You could win one of three cash prizes. Visit bchydro.com/innovationchallenge before November 30th to find out more.
That you can join for free, and kids in every neighborhood belong. It's a funny company, 'cause it's just for fun, you see. So come on running when you hear our song.
All you people care about is readers and making money off of her. She's a human! Leave Brittany alone!
If you don't want to miss your favorite CITR show because it makes fun of the spiel, then you've got nothing to worry about. Now you can get all of the CITR 101.9 FM radio shows off our website and download them straight onto your computer or MP3 players. Just visit www.citr.ca/podcast and dive into a pool of all of the past radio shows, such as...
Because all you people want is more, 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 more! Leave her alone!
All to your little heart's desire.
This is News 101, and the current time is 5:16. Now with a look at other BC news, we're joined in studio by News 101 reporters Tracy Fuller and Carrie Baptist.
As of January 1st, 2008, babies born in BC will receive a new high-tech birth certificate from the provincial government. As part of the national effort to prevent identity theft, the new certificates will be equipped with 20 state-of-the-art safety features, including watermarks and color-shifting transparent windows. Health Minister George Abbott said the change is part of a nationwide effort by the provincial and territorial ministers responsible for vital statistics to increase identity security. The new cards will be distributed by the Ministry of Health, and the price will remain at $27.
Students at the University of Northern British Columbia are angry over the installation of new fingerprint scanners to control access to the university's gym facilities. More than 300 students of the university have signed an online petition against the scanners, calling the American-made RecTrack biometric scanning system an invasion of their privacy. Students are concerned over how the fingerprint information is being collected, where it's being stored, and what groups have access to their information. Bob Van Adrichem, UNBC's Director of Media and Public Relations, says that the system is not only secure but also convenient because students will no longer have to show a card or wear a shoe tag before working out in the university's gym. BC's Privacy and Information Commissioner, David Ludichelis, says that with more technologies like the RecTrack system, cheaper and more widespread, the government wants to ensure the technologies being used are appropriate.
Provincial Finance Minister Carol Taylor said she will not run for re-election in 2009. Taylor made the announcement at a news conference called to present a quarterly report on the provincial budget. However, the news that the finance minister would not run in the next election overshadowed any budget talk. Reporters were only interested in what Taylor's political future holds, but the minister refused to say what her future plans are, saying she is only focused on the upcoming provincial budget. Taylor denies persistent rumors that the reason she is stepping down is to run for mayor of Vancouver. Taylor is credited with reversing the Liberal Party's slide in the polls by spending the provincial budget surplus on social programs. Premier Campbell downplayed the significance of a star finance minister leaving after serving only one term, saying that being a cabinet minister is only a 4-year commitment, not 8.
We're going to take another break now, but when we come back, we'll update you on national and international news. Stay with us. News 101 will continue right after this.
Sometimes I feel special, like an apostle of Jesus or something.
And how does it make you feel?
Like I want to hustle!
Yes, I see.
You don't need a psychologist to know that what you crave is Apostle of Hustle, the ultimate indie rock band. CITR presents Apostle of Hustle Saturday, December 8th at the Plaza Club on Granville Street. Come out for a chance to hear them play new music from their album National Anthem of Nowhere.
That'll cure anybody.
A professional opinion would be to recommend A Pulse of Hustle Chew. Yes.
#5:19 and the news continues on CITR. The loonie took a blow to its all-time high this afternoon. Our dollar did slip below the American dollar this afternoon before recovering close to par. Ultimately, the dollar fell today by almost 0.3 cents from Thursday afternoon. It also slipped on Tuesday. Part of the decline is being attributed to the gross domestic product growth decline, as well as the decline of oil prices. Today's gross domestic product figures for Canada did show that a growth in the third quarter has slowed to 2.9% from a booming 3.8% in the second quarter. The decline is said to be better than what analysts had anticipated. Crude oil is also said to be a reason for today's decline. Prices fell below $90 U.S. a barrel for the first time in over a month because of the fears of a slowing U.S. economy. With more on national news, here again are Carrie Baptist and Tracy Fuller.
There's some good news and some bad news coming out of a new sex survey regarding women 16 to 24 years old in Canada. The good news is teen pregnancy is on the decline and youths are waiting longer to engage in sexual intercourse. The bad news is 2/3 of women surveyed don't use a condom every time they have sex, and 1 in 5 girls never use a condom. Sexual health educator Salima Noon is not surprised by the numbers, but she is concerned. A big worry is that only 28% of women on the pill say they take the pill at the same time every day. The rest of the women admit to skipping their pills or varying the times they take them. 54% say the pill they're on doesn't work well with their bodies and would be open to switching brands. Noon adds that there are other STIs aside from AIDS that are prevalent among youths, including chlamydia, gonorrhea, and the human papillomavirus.
The Toronto Police have charged an Ontario College of Art and Design student in connection with a bomb hoax at the Royal Ontario Museum. Thorin Inge Johnson, 24, was confirmed by investigators to be connected to the hoax, which involved a fake bomb and YouTube video. He had reportedly turned himself into the police on November 29th and was charged with common nuisance and mischief that interferes with property. Currently, he has been released on a $33,000 bail. Johnson said that he left a fake pipe bomb, which he described as a sculpture, in a bag at the museum with a note that indicated that it was not a bomb. Then he went to his third-year production class to present a video he made called The Fake Bombing at the ROM, which he posted on YouTube. Consequently, a major fundraiser for the Canadian Foundation for AIDS Research was cancelled. Detective Leslie Dunkley, who investigated the case, told reporters that the incident has impacted on many police resources and members of the public.
And in international news, after more than 20 years of injustice, former Argentine military leader Jorge Rafael Videla and 16 others will be prosecuted on charges of conspiring to kidnap and kill political activists during the reign of Operation Condor in South America in the 1970s and 80s. FSRN reports with more.
Former military dictator Jorge Rafael Videla and 16 other military leaders in Argentina will be prosecuted on charges of conspiring to kidnap and kill political activists in a scheme known as Plan Condor, developed by Henry Kissinger and George Bush Sr., head of the CIA at the time. Dictators in Uruguay, Chile, Paraguay, Brazil, and Argentina killed opponents in the 1970s and 80s under the plan, which was also called Operation Condor. Marie Trigona reports from Argentina, where some 30,000 people were disappeared as a result, leaving loved ones to seek justice decades later.
My name is Emmy Dambra, mother of two disappeared, a girl and a boy. The girl was disappeared here in Buenos Aires.
In front of the clandestine detention center where her daughter was tortured while pregnant and later murdered, Emmy Dambra participated in a homage to victims of Plan Condor. Inside the Orletti Auto Garage, which also functioned as a clandestine detention center tucked in a residential neighborhood in Buenos Aires, hundreds perished. Not only Argentines, but also citizens from Uruguay, Cuba, Chile, and Bolivia. According to Dambra, those responsible for leading the bloody military junta should be put behind bars and not like former dictator Jorge Rafael Videla under house arrest.
Orletti was the prototype example of Plan Condor. Here they held prisoners from Uruguay and other countries.
Former dictator Jorge Videla, now 82, is currently under house arrest, already found guilty for stealing babies born in captivity during the bloody junta. The former dictator may now face a jail cell for his participation in Operation Condor, a transnational state-sponsored terrorist coalition among the militaries of the Southern Cone of Latin America. In 1977, Videla, speaking to journalists, recognized the phenomenon of forced disappearances, but suggested they were disappeared because they were participating in armed clandestine struggle.
In our country, people have been disappeared. This is a sad reality. But objectively, we should recognize why and through whom they were disappeared. These people went disappeared because they went clandestine.
At least 25 Bolivian citizens were disappeared in Argentina during the 1976-83 military dictatorship. Ruth Shanos, a representative from the Bolivian Association of Family Members of the Detained and Disappeared, said regional dictatorships use Plan Condor to target dissidents with the support of former U.S. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger.
Centralmente, el Plan Condor.
Plan Condor was a joint plan developed through Henry Kissinger, a criminal who hasn't been punished yet. The plan established with the military dictatorships in Latin America was a process of forced disappearances of all social activists who in the 70s and 80s were looking for a social transformation in their respective countries.
Patrick Rice, an Irish priest who was disappeared by a commando group in a Buenos Aires shantytown in 1976, said the internationally coordinated disappearances of people continues today.
A phenomenon is happening more and more now in the context of what is called the global war on terrorism, where the practices of enforced disappearances with secret detention centres such as Guantanamo would return to the use of the hood. The hood for us is a symbol of disappearances. People detained in places on the slowest location. The practice of extraordinary renditions. All of this point, which is a new form of the Operación Condor.
Videla and other military leaders will face trial early next year. Human rights groups continue to push for nations to sign the UN-sanctioned Treaty Against Forced Disappearances, which the U.S. has refused to ratify. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Marie Trigono, Buenos Aires.
Saturday night is the only...
And thanks to Free Speech Radio News for making that piece available for rebroadcast. In other international news, world-renowned daredevil Evel Knievel has died at the age of 69 at his home in Florida, succumbing to the effects of pulmonary fibrosis, which he had been battling for years. The stuntman, who spent the greater part of his life thrilling the audiences with his daring motorcycle tricks and outrageous costumes, broke more than 40 bones as a result of his stunts, including his back, 7 times. Needless to say, his final years were plagued with pain as the result of his many accidents. Knievel was once quoted in Esquire magazine as saying that anybody can jump a motorcycle, the trouble begins when you try to land it. It's now time for another break here on News 101, but stay tuned for commentary and much more coming up on the other side.
UBC.
That's right, it's Pride UBC Queer Garden happening tomorrow night, Friday, 7 p.m. at Sub 214. Come out for a night of dancing and good times. Queers and allies welcomed.
That's right, this is not the Thunderdome, folks. This is real roller derby action. Check it out.
Need your monthly fix of girls hitting each other on skates? Well, it's your lucky day. We practice once a month, and we want you to come and watch. You like to watch, don't you? The Terminal City Roller Girls Monthly Scrimmage, Sunday, December 2nd from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. at the UBC Osborne Center, 6108 Thunderbird Boulevard, Unit 2. Bring a warm jacket. Despite the hot roller derby action, it can get pretty cold in there. And don't forget, we want to have more places to hold events in Vancouver, so we're still saving up for that darn sport court floor. We'll pass the hat at intermission, so any kind donations would be much appreciated. The Terminal City Roller Girls Monthly Scrimmage, Sunday, December 2nd, 2007, at the UBC Osborne Center.
Are you a UBC student taking first-year economics, math, chemistry, or physics?
That stuff is hard.
Are you feeling like you need some tutoring? That's okay, because the AMS offers free and appointment tutoring for students in these subjects.
Whoa!
How does it work?
It's on a first-come, first-served basis, and there's no need to sign up. Just show up with your books and your questions.
Whoa!
When does it happen?
Monday to Thursday from 3 to 7 at the Sub Pacific Spirit Cafeteria, located beside the Starbucks.
Whoa!
A+, here I come.
Welcome back to News 101. It's now time for commentary, and this week, Phil Caudry takes a look at Vanock's choice of the three mascots to promote Vancouver in the 2010 Winter Olympics.
It's official. The marketing division responsible for promoting the Vancouver 2010 Olympics have set a course for PR embarrassment. Following the 2005 unveiling of the dismal 2010 Olympic logo, the Vancouver 2010 Organizing Committee have outdone themselves by producing three disturbing mascots for the Games. In 2005, the organizing committee embarrassed all level-headed Vancouverites by choosing a rainbow-colored Inukshuk, a traditional stone sculpture used by Inuits, as the game's logo. Apparently, the committee didn't receive the memo that British Columbia is not the Northwest Territories and therefore does not have an Inuit population. To add further insult, Vancouver, being the next host of the Winter Olympics, ended the closing ceremonies during the 2006 Torino Games in unrepresentative fashion. The performance focused heavily on Inuit and First Nations dances, without presenting a more representative portrait of the West Coast. The performance was almost universally panned and mocked by journalists. So the Olympic Committee had an opportunity to redeem themselves, but instead did not capitalize on this opportunity and chose to squander it instead. The horrific mascots consisted of a trio of cartoon characters, who looked like they didn't make the cut for Pokemon. One of these characters is a combination of an orca and a spirit bear that the designers say enjoys surfing and snowboarding in its spare time. Her costume consists of a fin coming out of her head. Sumi, the Paralympic mascot, is a horned hat-wearing thunderbird who likes alpine skiing. And last, but certainly not least, is Quachi, a Sasquatch. Yes, a Sasquatch. One that wears blue earmuffs. These half-baked creations can only be a product of BC, because you would have to be at least half-baked to create these monstrosities. To try to make everyone happy, the committee created three distinct mascots, but in the end, had a problem three times bigger than it should have had. A fictitious monster, an orca-bear hybrid, and a thunderbird who skis. Always a winning combination. Although mascots generally are not intended to carry a heavy load of representing the host city's culture and history, after the Inukshuk logo and our Closing Ceremonies Act in 2006, the mascots could have been a turnaround. How about the endangered spirit bear as the mascot? That would represent wildlife, environmental stewardship, and credibility all at once. Plus, it could raise awareness about the diminishing number of spirit bears remaining in BC. Sure, the hybrid animal mascot is part spirit bear, but it loses its message completely by being bred with an orca. So you might ask yourself, why does this matter, and why am I deviating from my usual commentary regarding Canadian politics? Well, because I believe in the Olympics working for BC and truly showcasing and presenting our people, values, and cultures accurately. If the Olympics is supposed to be an opportunity for BC to attract more tourism and investment, why not present a PR campaign that isn't tacky and uninformative? Sure, the plush toys might sell well in the 2-10 demographic. When it comes to attracting tourism and investment, with the Olympic Committee failing to capitalize on any of the marketing channels at its disposal, there is a serious problem. For the sake of all British Columbians, let's hope this colossal misfire of a PR campaign does not translate into a colossal execution of the actual Winter Olympic Games. For News 101 Commentary, I'm Phil Caudry.
And thanks, as always, for that piece, Phil. I know there certainly has been a lot of chatter regarding the three mascots, even here at UBC. Do you have anything to say about that, Katie?
I don't know. I'm kind of perplexed. Rita, you brought up a good point during the break. Since when did cartoon characters become so incredibly political? I mean, it's just supposed to be a mascot representing, you know, 2 weeks of an international sporting event hosted here in Vancouver. And yes, it was a disappointment to many Vancouverites because there is a general sentiment it doesn't represent BC as a whole. But to an extent, it almost feels like this is being blown majorly out of proportion. I don't know. But what do you think on this?
Well, I agree with that. Although one of the things I think that a lot of people are missing is that the Olympics already are so contentious. And there's this problem with, I think there's some sort of figure I heard the other day about the Olympic Committee needing to sell about $500 million worth of merchandise, which would be predominantly these mascots. And for people to be so unhappy about them and to have that expectation intention of selling so much money. I think there's something wrong there for sure. Is it just an issue of consumerism and poor consumerism at that?
Mm-hmm. Well, we were discussing the price of the actual plush mascots at the Bay downtown, and one of our reporters was saying that they were going for something like $95 a piece. And if they're targeting the 2 to 10 demographic, as Phil is saying, that's not an affordable children's toy. It's just not going to be something that's going to end up under the Christmas tree this holiday season. So,
right.
I don't know. But and with the actual mascots themselves, I have a problem with them being hybrids. I think they're a little hard to explain to people, and especially for someone who doesn't live here. We all know what BC is about. We can, you know, tell that a Sasquatch is something remotely BC-ish, but I don't know, the hybrid sea bear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also myself being a Vancouver Island native, I like the tribute to the marmot, but I also find it completely depressing at the same time that we can sort of, you know, glamorize the animal and make it into a plush toy, but we can't save the animal. There's like two left on the island or something. So on a lighter note, I really like Selena Ferris's idea of our mascot being the pine beetle, because that truly is, you know, the organism of choice for the up-and-coming.
Definitely the most prevalent in BC.
Right.
But who knows, maybe people's minds will change by 2010, and we'll give it 2 years and see how everyone feels.
See how it plays out. So moving on, we won't be hearing from our foreign correspondent Peter Otis this Friday, but our producer Megan Turcato is here again with a look at our oddity of the week. Megan.
Thanks, Rita. Today our oddity comes to you from London, England, where a new initiative by Westminster City Council promises that Londoners will never have to spend their time searching for a WC. The new program launched today is called SatLab and will find the nearest public facility for anyone with a cell phone. Tourists, theatergoers, shoppers, and pub patrons in London's popular West End can now text the word toilet and receive a text back with the address of the nearest loo. The service is able to locate the caller's position by the strength of their cell phone signal. The purpose of this plan is to prevent people from relieving themselves in the alleyways. The council has measured the magnitude of this problem and found that some 4,500 liters of urine end up in Westminster streets every year. SatLab's claim to fame is that it's the first text-based toilet finder in Britain, but apparently not in the entire world.
Wow.
I'm actually kind of impressed. That's pretty ingenious because, you know, there's moments when you come out of a club and, you know, you're far from home and you really have to go to the washroom, but you just can't find one. I mean, Vancouver, we don't have an abundance of public toilets, but in London there is. So it's pretty great service.
Maybe this is a thought for Sam Sullivan's Civil City project.
I do know that it is a struggle in general in large European cities to find a free public washroom. And the first time I went to Europe, I remember my friend who I was traveling with saying, okay, here's the plan. If you ever need to use a toilet, you got to find a McDonald's. That's the only real option you have other than going to a bar and paying, you know, 15 cents to use their washroom. So it's great for that problem, I suppose.
I don't know. If you find yourself in a bind, at least you know there's an option. Just text toilet. And
that means you bring your telephone with you, I guess. But that's another story.
Well, kudos to the British government for figuring that one out. Okay, it's break time again, but coming up next, it's the Arts Report with Katie Fitzpatrick. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Menstruation, the final frontier. This is the research of SEMCOR, its continuing mission to explore strange yet familiar body parts, to seek out new information unfamiliar to the medical profession, to boldly go where no man has gone before. Tired of frantically raising your shields with those unexpected periods? Fed up of not really understanding what's going on in the nether regions of your space? Come to the Center for Menstrual Cycle and Ovulation Research and learn how to live long and prosper through all phases of your cycle. SEMCOR can give you the tools to chart your way through your cycle so it seems like a safe space rather than the outer reaches of the galaxy. Our prime directive is to educate women about their bodies so they can have peace and a long life. To that end, we're recruiting volunteers for a menstrual cycle and ovulation study involving a personal log and urine samples. all completed in the privacy of your own quarters. Participants must be between the ages of 20 and 40, have menstruated in the last 3 months, and not be taking any hormonal medications such as birth control pills. Resistance is futile. Set your coordinates to www.semcor.ubc.ca or call 604-875-5960. We're the Center for Menstrual Cycle and Ovulation Research.
Sunday, December 2nd, tune in to CITR 101.9 FM for a 12-hour marathon of The Rocker Show. Not only is it George Barrett's birthday, but he is celebrating 25 years on CITR Radio. Tune in for some special guests and some great tunes. The Rocker Show 25-year anniversary special. Sunday, December 2nd.
Welcome back to News 101 on CITR. I'm Katie Comley, alongside Rita Farkas, coming to you live from the Student Union Building at UBC. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Right now it's 5:40 p.m. and time to turn things over to Katie Fitzpatrick for a look at the arts.
Hello and welcome to your 5-Minute Arts Beat. I'm Katie Fitzpatrick. Here are this week's listings. First up in theater, there's John and Beatrice. Pi Theater presents Carol Fretchett's modern love story, translated by John Morrell, about the challenges of finding a companion in an increasingly insular society. That's at the Paul Theater on Cordero, and that is December 1st, tomorrow night. There's also Some Men. Raving Theater presents the Canadian premiere of Terrence McNally's Exploration of Gay Culture and Relationships. That is at Performance Works on Cartwright on Granville Island, and that is December 2nd on Sunday. The Ecstasy of Rita Joe, Canadian playwright George Riga's classic drama about an Aboriginal woman who moves to the city and finds herself caught between two cultures. I'm actually going to be checking that one out tonight. It's at the Firehall Arts Center on East Cordova, and I'll have a review for you all in Arts Express on Tuesdays. Here's an interesting one showing at the Havana, Catholic Schoolgirls. Ryan Mooney directs Cassie Curdy's play about four Catholic schoolgirls entering adolescence in 1960s New York. Once again, that's at the Havana, and that's tomorrow night. In dance, there's Lost Action. Kid Pivot performs choreography by artistic director Crystal Pite, with original music by Owen Belton. That's at the Vancouver East Cultural Center on Venables, tomorrow at 8 p.m. Also in dance, there's Baseline. Edom presents an improvised performance with American dance artist Nancy Stark-Smith and Edom's artistic director Peter Bingham. That is December 7th to 8th at the Edom Studio Theater on East 8th. In music, there's Proteges and Masters. Alexander Mikhail Thwaite conducts the VSO and guest soloist Giori Schmidt on violin. That is at the Orpheum Theater at Seymour and Smythe, and that's tomorrow at 8 p.m. Also coming up here at UBC, there's Verdi Messa de Requiem. The UBC School of Music presents a concert featuring soprano Amy Lefroy, mezzo-soprano Wendy Hatala-Folly, and tenor Matthew Stevenson. That's at the Chan Center for the Performing Arts, and we're going to have a review of that coming up any minute by arts volunteer Tracy Fuller. A couple of galleries you may want to check out right now. There's Swagger, Images by Angela Grossman Explore the World of Young Boys. That's at the Diane Ferris Gallery. Another interesting one is the Reincarnation of W. Vancouver artists reflect on the red neon W of the Woodward's department store sign. That's at the Gallery Gachet on East Cordova. Literary event at the moment, the Wish Emerging Voices, Poets and Writers. Wish Drop-In Center presents author Colleen Bryant reading from her collection of short stories, In the Dry Woods, followed by poetry readings. That is tomorrow from 7 to 10 p.m. at the Rhizome Cafe on East Broadway. Finally, if you're into movies, a couple new things opening up tonight. One is the new Bob Dylan movie, I'm Not There, which I'm also going to be reviewing next week on Arts Express. And the other is Melarepa, Magician, Murderer, and Saint. Those are both playing at Fifth Avenue. Now up next, it's the opera review with arts volunteer Tracy Fuller.
Break out your black habit. A funeral mass that's not to be missed is happening tomorrow night at the Chan Center for Performing Arts. The thunderous and chilling music of Giuseppe Verdi's monumental Messa de Requiem will be filling every crevice of the performance hall at 8 p.m. Combining the talents of UBC's Choral Union, the University Singers, the Vancouver Bach Choir, and the University Symphony Orchestra, over 400 performers will come together to deliver a musical funeral setting that audiences won't soon forget. The Requiem was written by Verdi to commemorate the death of his friend, the Italian writer and humanist Alessandro Manzoni, who died in 1873. First drafted as part of a collaborative requiem for the great Italian composer Rossini, Verdi's Libera Mia was to be premiered in 1869. But when that performance was canceled, Verdi kept working on the piece, expanding it towards a full requiem entirely of his own composition. When his friend Manzoni died, he dedicated the work to his memory, and Verdi's Messa de Requiem premiered in Milan in 1874. Best known for its penetrating arrangement of Dies Irae, the Latin lyrics describe the Day of Judgment using trochaic meter. The arresting hymn represents the last call of trumpets summoning lost souls to the throne of God. Some will be saved while others are damned. Audience members should prepare themselves to be absolutely submerged in sound. Bring a jacket. This mass will be thrilling and chilling from start to finish. Soloists for the performance include Amy Lefroy, Wendy Foley, Matthew Stephenson, and Gary Relier. Conducted by Bruce Pullen, a limited number of tickets are still available at the Chan Center box office. This is the funeral to attend this holiday season, so if you haven't already scheduled your own, be sure not to miss this one. It's sure to be killer. For the Arts Report, I'm Tracy Fuller.
And before we go tonight, we'll check in with meteorologist Selena Ferris for a look at your weekend weather. Selena.
Well, I have some bad news for all those keeping track of the snow levels on the local mountains. Despite a cold and snowy weekend coming up, temps will be rising and the snow will be melting at the start of next week. Tomorrow and Sunday in the city, there will be a mix of snow and rain with temperatures hovering around zero. Monday will be hit with the Pineapple Express. Expect rain and temperatures up to 12 degrees for the early week. That's your weekend weather, brought to you by the Storm Club at UBC. For more information, you can email us at stormubc@gmail.com.
Thank you, Selena. I know there will be many people concerned about their precious snowpack on the mountains. Yeah.
Especially with the mountains just trying to open this weekend.
Right, yeah. Well, better luck next weekend maybe, hey?
Yeah.
Okay.
We'll see.
Thanks. So that's our program for November 30th, 2007. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. And if you'd like to share your comments, give us a hot news tip, or get involved with the show, contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email news@citr.ca.
Megan Turcato produced this radio program. For more news, join us Monday at 5 p.m. for the next edition of News 101. For the entire news team here at CITR, I'm Katie Comley.
And I'm Rita Farkas. Thanks for listening this evening. Coming up next, CITR Sports Friday. This evening, the men's and women's basketball teams take on their cross-water rivals, the Victoria Vikes, live from War Memorial Gym. This is CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Our podcast update number 5.
Work has begun on Canada's information highway. That's the